And for the last few years, more countries have been becoming authoritarian than have been becoming more democratic. We have a backslide around the world of democracies into authoritarianism, and in large part because of the ways they're trying to control the information environment. There was a couple of years ago, Pakistan led, with a few other not so democratic countries, including Russia, a resolution on disinformation at the UN. And so here you have these authoritarian states that are presenting a view of best practices. They want to collect best practices on how to counter disinformation. And so they're really using that whole concept too as a means for greater control over their individual information ecosystems and what that means. And that's what I worry about, right?
This is Cloak and Dagger, a podcast about OSINT, technology, and global conflict. I'm MJ Banias. This podcast is powered by Sapper Labs Group. For more, visit www.sapperlabs.com. In this episode, I need to tell a story from a really long time ago. So let me set the mood here with some music. Hold on. Okay, so this is the story about King Charles I.
You have a conflict in Europe that is attempting to drag England into it, and it's a religious war. I'm Dr. Alicia Wanless. I am a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where I run a project called the Partnership for Countering Influence Operations.
It's the early 1600s, and Europe is embroiled in the Thirty Years' War. It's a religious conflict between Catholics and Protestants vying for political and territorial dominance in Europe. While England lent some nominal support to the Protestant side under King James VI, England had very little interest in getting fully involved. Okay, fast forward a bit. King James dies, and his son Charles I inherits the throne in 1625. And this is where stuff gets spicy. So, Charles is king of a very Protestant England, and he marries Princess Henrietta Maria of France a few months later. And for all my history buffs out there, I bet you can guess why this causes problems. France is a Catholic country. Now, to make matters worse, Charles's religious views were pretty conservative. He was a firm believer in the divine right of kings, and often fought with the British Parliament, whose job was to keep the king's power in check. He levied taxes without Parliament's consent. He made a lot of enemies with the gentry, who felt that he was too abusive in his role as monarch. He also didn't provide much aid to the Protestant countries of Europe as they fought the Thirty Years' War, and he also tried to tell Scotland how to be better Anglicans, which they didn't appreciate. He's super buddy-buddy with the Spanish ambassador, who, you know, is also Catholic, and he also married this Catholic girl before. There's Catholics everywhere.
You had this information ecosystem that was actually quite porous despite his attempts to control it. And so you had, not long before that, the invention of the printing press, which resulted in information floods, like many more books being published, but a lot more pamphlets. So pamphlets, and you have the invention of news that's coming out, and people are sending letters to each other that are keeping people updated.
So, you know, there's talk. Pamphlets and letters start getting published that question the king's loyalty to the country and to the faith. Newsbooks from outside England find themselves in the hands of English readers, with apocalyptic treatises saying that if England doesn't join the war, the world will end. Other pamphlets appear saying that Charles is actually part of a complicated conspiracy and in league with the Catholic Pope, trying to make England Catholic again. Counter stories get published too, trying to paint various lords and nobles as liars and pointing the finger at them as being treasonous. You can imagine how confusing all this would have been for the 17th century mind.
And so there's all sorts of disinformation that is flowing about Charles and these ideas that he is going to try to bring England back to the Catholic Church, and his wife, who is a French Catholic, only helps fuel these kinds of rumors, and he allows her to keep practicing, and he has very deep connections with like the Spanish ambassador, which is one of the reasons why he introduces these laws against slander.
So Charles makes a bold move. He essentially deplatforms the pamphleteers and bookmakers. He says, "You can't publish anything slanderous about me, the crown, the queen." Basically, he issues a gag order. But we all know what happens when you try to ban something. It only makes it cooler.
And so it's not really looking good for him. And at the same time, he's cut himself off from the people. So he has established his favorites in power while disregarding the landed gentry. So now he no longer has this feedback loop, which may not have been the best of feedback loops, but that's the kind of system that you're dealing with at this time. So he's not necessarily hearing or understanding what the concerns are from the ground up, from the people.
Without the feedback from the pamphleteers and the lords and nobles, without all those voices in his ear, Charles essentially loses control. England slips into a civil war. First, Scotland revolts, and then the English Parliament turns too. They secure London, and they basically force Charles to flee in 1642. It shakes down basically to the lords and nobles who control the British Parliament on one side, versus the king himself on the other. Battle lines get drawn, armies get raised, and the disinformation continues to flow. Factions that wanted to reach a peace settlement and the factions that longed for war spun up those old printing presses and they got to, well, I guess typesetting. Conspiracies form about Charles attempting to negotiate in bad faith, or how he was insincere about wanting a peaceful resolution. Full-blown war erupts, and for about 5 years, England is a divided nation.
And then the layer that used to advise him and trust him is also kind of cut off. So it's this perfect storm in which you have new technology that's been introduced, you have a growing population who is literate, you have a growing class of people who have made money now off of the colonies in North America in particular, and they're all clamoring for a new idea, which is greater involvement in Parliament. So you have the beginning of the modern state, the modern society here. And these people start pushing for that reform. Now, their desires for reform and their new ideas of what governance should be is in conflict with Charles and his view of what monarchy should be, which is absolute. And so as the new views take hold, Charles digs in and really tries to control his information environment to stop these new views from coming. And ultimately, it ends up in conflict where he loses his head.
Charles effectively loses the war by 1648. There's some cool political drama between all these lords who just want a war, with deals being struck and then counter-struck. Charles trying to negotiate his way out of capture, and then some great cloak and dagger plots where people end up getting stabbed to death. Regardless, in January of 1649, Charles's trial comes to an end, and a British parliamentarian and general named Oliver Cromwell, you may have heard the name, he was a pretty big deal in England, like the Beatles, he basically pushes that Charles needs to be executed for treason. So, on a chilly January 30th in 1649, it was a Tuesday, Charles gets walked through the streets of London to the executioner's scaffold. He gives a pretty okay speech, rests his neck on the block, and at 2 p.m., with one clean stroke, well, you can imagine the rest.
in my thesis, my PhD thesis, I looked at five examples from across time, starting with the Peloponnesian War and ending with Ukraine. And attempts to block disinformation seldom work. One is that it's impossible to filter out. King Charles I wasn't able to do it in a limited information ecosystem where he had control of at least the printing process. He couldn't control letters and everything else, but he certainly tried. He made it illegal to slander him. He couldn't manage to stem the tide of disinformation that was being spread about him or related to him that was detrimental. How do we hope to do this in a really highly complex, globally interconnected information environment? At the same time, I've got all sorts of questions about how effective it is to do that anyway. Because if you try to take information that people have already come to believe away from them, are we going to be facing this scarcity heuristic where people now value the information they couldn't access anymore at a greater degree than it should have been or it would have been if you just left it there?
So
I actually researched the information environment, which is the wider system where phenomena like disinformation occur. Disinformation itself is one problem among many in that space. It tends to be defined as misleading or false information that is intentionally spread. I think the problem is that the research isn't necessarily there for us to understand disinformation beyond it existing. We have lots of evidence of activity, of it occurring, of people spreading it. We have some sense or inclination that it is possibly causing people to make bad decisions. Getting to the bottom of really understanding its role in the wider information environment is a lot harder because a number of reasons. One is that we don't actually really have much baselining material about disinformation. Like we say it's increasing, but we don't necessarily know because we don't really study the system where it occurs to be able to say whether, you know, it didn't or did exist before. For example, vaccine hesitancy. That's been around for a long time. That's been something that humans have struggled with at least since the smallpox vaccine and has continued through this day. It's just that we had an event with a global pandemic that really brought it to the fore. And so we have these challenges all the time, but we aren't necessarily looking at things before and after they occur. So if we really wanted to understand something like disinformation, we'd need to be able to look at the environment where it happens, be able to know what that ecosystem looks like before disinformation is introduced, or whether it's increasing, to be able to measure it, to say that it is or not. What happens inside that ecosystem, not just like people adopting certain views at the same time, but what other factors might be driving people towards certain points of view, and then how are they actually reacting overall to disinformation. It could be possible that there's natural resilience in which people start to discard certain types of information that are low quality, and then they manage to find solutions on their own. But we really don't know because we're just looking at the disinformation itself.
So it seems to be that you have a broader kind of information system, just how people share, collect, contribute to this kind of pool of shared information we all kind of draw from. How then do we start like sectioning this pool off into different areas? Or is that not even possible and you need to look at this in a more holistic sense of how information just flows into other pieces of information, whether it's real or not?
I think the problem is that we've been looking at aspects of the information environment in piecemeal. So we're only looking at specific things in isolation, and we're not necessarily putting it back into the context of what an information ecosystem is. So we tend to be very, I would say, media driven. So whatever's getting coverage is whatever gets the most kind of research coverage and then policy response. And those things tend to be events, right? So it's elections, pandemics, conflicts, disasters. It's specific pieces of technology. So whatever's being covered or whatever might be more accessible to study. So for a long time, the research around topics like disinformation and social media was heavily skewed towards Twitter because they had far more data that was available for research purposes. But now it's AI, and you've got AI centers popping up everywhere. The third issue is that we look at specific threats. So disinformation after 2016 and the election in the US became a big area of focus. But before that, it was violent extremism and a host of others. So we get fixated on specific threats. And then the fourth area is that we look at threat actors. So as a Russia hand, I remember when nobody cared about Russia. And then suddenly in 2016, it became a hot topic again, but tomorrow it could be China or Iran or whatever. And so we tend to look at these things in pieces, and we're not really putting it together. We're not looking at how those campaigns either interact with others. We don't necessarily look at all of the other factors that might go into people receiving that and shaping it and what they might do with it. And what I'm talking about here, when I'm talking about the information environment, is really this wider system that we all live in and are a part of. It's the space where humans and machines process information to make sense of the world. It includes all the underlying technology that helps move information through channels like television, radio, social media, whatever else is going to come, but also the content itself. And this is a very dynamic system in which all of these factors are interacting with each other, but we don't even really have a grip or good definitions of what that space means yet.
This all kind of makes sense. I mean, this is really how humans work. The most direct and obvious threat is what we like to deal with first, but we don't really pause often to understand why that threat is there in the first place, or why it even is a threat, or what conditions turned it into a threat. Disinformation doesn't exist in a bubble.
I think that there's a lot to be said for that, that we are very much in the now and reactive and responsive, and our modern information environment really triggers that more so, right? So we have 24-hour news that is basically becoming very clickbaity, trying to get people's attention. A lot of emotions are used in that to try to engage people. We also have social media all the time. We're hooked on devices. We're feeding ourselves more information. It's not necessarily that it's just coming at us, but we're like choosing to take it. And so I think that there is an aspect of that. At the same time, we've shown that we can build fields, scientific fields in the past, right? Before understanding the physical environment would have seemed really complex and hard. But over time, biologists in particular started to build up a scientific approach to categorizing, observing, analyzing the world around us to get us to a point where at least we have some sort of basic understanding at this point. Humans still make really stupid mistakes in the physical world, but I think we're getting a little bit better. Now, the challenge here is if we don't start to understand the information environment, this is the space where all public decision making is happening. And in the context of democracy, if it's highly polluted and people are no longer making free and informed decisions, the very legitimacy of democracy is at risk. And we have very huge existential crises that we're facing. We just are coming out of a pandemic. Lord knows when the next one's going to happen. We have climate change facing us. How are we actually going to be able to do anything about those problems if we don't understand the information environment and we can't figure out what makes a healthy information environment in the context of democracies to get us ahead?
Okay, so we are being bombarded by information, both real and unreal. Facts merged with fiction. So why does disinformation work? Like, why do people often fall for it?
I think everybody is susceptible, sure, and everybody to a degree can be targeted, sure, by it.
Sure.
I think, and if they're not targeted by it to believe it, they may be targeted in a different way to silence them, which is what is unfortunately happening to the research community right now in the U.S. who were looking at disinformation, especially in the context of the U.S. Here's the thing. Disinformation is right. Like one form of information pollution. Okay. It's one like really deliberate kind. There are so many terms that are bandied around. There's that. Then there's misinformation, which is spread unintentionally, and supposedly disinformation that is then spread unwittingly by somebody who believes it and doesn't know it's disinformation. It becomes misinformation. Then you have malinformation and all of these terms that are floating around, which suggests that we actually have a conceptual problem for understanding what's happening. And to my mind, that means, number one, we should probably stop coming up with new terms and try to understand whether there's like a bigger phenomenon here that's happening. I would come back to the fact that disinformation, if this is what we want to talk about, is one tactic among many that people use to influence. It often does not just go by itself. It often does not just come out of nowhere. It's built on things that people in that target audience are already believing or seeing. It's really difficult to distinguish whether it's being done intentionally or it's just like pre-existing views that people are putting out there. It's been around for a long time. Humans do this. We create reasons or explanations, especially when we're in periods of uncertainty. They could be rumors. They could be, you know, just faulty information because our foundation or our education led us to some sort of faulty thinking, et cetera. And in that context, there's this question of like, is this just a human byproduct that sometimes people use deliberately? And is that really the problem, or are there underlying factors that are allowing this to be more of a problem? Is it a symptom?
It's almost like disinformation itself is like a concept, because you can't really pin it down or nail it down as to what it actually is, like doesn't fundamentally exist, right?
I think that's the crux of the problem, right? So right now, I mean, and again, I'm Canadian, but I work mostly in the US, or at least for a US institution. So this exposes me a lot to the American ecosystem. And right now, I think you genuinely have a split of realities. Like the reality, the views of reality are not the same across party lines, the farther you go from left to right. And what is categorized as disinformation by one is a belief by the other. And on one hand, I mean, I would love to say that there's got to be objective truths out there. And I know where my worldview falls on many of those things. At the same time, if you have policymakers, legislators who fully believe or at least say they believe certain things that may not be truthful or they may be misleading or not entirely accurate, how are you going to do much about this problem? I think that there's always going to be an aspect of people having different viewpoints, like think about religions, different viewpoints, different ideas, different perspectives that in a democracy somehow need to be accommodated. Now, what concerns me about where we are now is that there can't be an accommodation now. It's like the two worldviews have become so incompatible that they can't give ground to either, and one has to dominate the other. And that, in my research, has kind of led to open conflict in the end. And I'm not sure what can be done at this point to stave that off, because the points of intervention were probably a lot earlier in the stage of things. And to my mind, that probably was like back when cable television suddenly introduced 24-hour news coverage. And then we had a quick succession of technological innovations that only sped up information processing and sharing to new degrees immediately after. I think that every time we introduce a new technology that changes how we process and share information, we have the same reaction and the same problem. There's too much information and we can't cope, and yet humans keep adapting. People complained about the alphabet being created, that it was going to kill the spoken language and it would no longer be living. After letters were becoming mainstream in like early modern Europe, you have secretaries complaining about the volume of letters that they have to deal with and how it's driving them crazy. But then they found ways to like systematize and process that. You have the same problem after books. You have the same problem with the telegraph. We just keep having that reaction. That is the reaction we're going to have to new technology. So my question would be is, if we can see that across time and history, then why can't we prepare ourselves? Because we know new technology is going to come. That's what humans do. We keep introducing new things that make the information environment more complex.
why don't we think through that and figure out what ways would help us to prepare instead of freaking out, say, 25 years later after it's been introduced, and now we have this split in worldviews and we've got these communities that are competing for dominance of their idea over the other. I think that we could get ahead of that and be more prepared, but to do that would mean we need to study the system so we can start to see patterns. We can see what happens before technology changes. We can see what kind of disturbances like information pollution, what they do to the environment, and find out what those perhaps natural ways of resilience are that would allow us to like recover faster. Because again, just like we're going to introduce new technology, we're going to keep polluting the information environment. Humans are just big polluters. We do this everywhere.
Would you say that we've kind of entered into a bit of a new world here in that everyone can be a creator, sharer of information, whereas, you know, with the previous examples of the alphabet being invented or letters or the printing press or whatever, those sources of information, the access to those pieces of information, the access to the tools that create that information were pretty limited.
I think that humans are generally very adaptable, and perhaps we are not giving them enough credit in their ability to adapt to this either. I mean, let's face it, they're still functioning. They've been exposed to all of this information. They're still going to their jobs. They're still operating. They haven't come to some sort of like computer brain freeze crash in which they can't cope. I think humans will try to find, as they always have, new tools for filtering and sorting and storing all of that information to try to get to the best quality information that they can. I think that it's always been in the hands of companies, unfortunately, at least in the Western world, private interests in most cases to develop that stuff, the means of production, the means of sorting, the means of storing. There's lots of questions around whether that is a good model and should they be doing all of that, that definitely need exploring. But I think by and large, we've been here before. We're going to be here again. It's probably going to be worse the next time. And we don't disappear. I mean, I think our bigger challenge is like, what does this highly polluted and complex and increasingly complex information environment mean for our ability to make decisions in the public interest?
Okay, so let's get into it then.
Well, I think in the context of the pandemic that we're coming out of, it's quite clear that it makes it extremely challenged.
Right. I mean, the whole COVID pandemic was this perfect petri dish of watching disinformation merge with conspiracy, with actual physical acts of rebellion. You had this open attack on science and data, which, you know, really isn't new, because we've seen it with climate change, but it led to this show of force where people gathered in some open revolt against science and data itself, and steps were taken to try and quash the disinformation, but it didn't work. It just pushed those people and that disinformation deeper into the seedier caves of the information ecosystem. I think I actually kind of get it now. It isn't just disinformation that pushes people into buying into false narratives and ideas. Sure, it plays a role, especially when it's kind of being artificially created for that purpose. But even the best state-sponsored lies need fertile soil. And to return to the COVID example, or climate change, or really even political ideologies, people's individual anxieties can make any problem seem insurmountable. Being asked to change how you live, the fear about a world spinning out of control, or feeling helpless, or wondering if you'll have a job tomorrow, how you'll feed your kids, being unsure of what to do, never being taught about this stuff by your parents or your school, and the fact that most people spend their nights staring into a hopeless little screen that just pummels them with all sorts of good and bad information, it can become overwhelming. And because it is overwhelming, we inherently seek out the voices that oversimplify the solution. We tend to ignore the nuance of it all. This is why disinformation can be so compelling. It makes simple a world so big and random and complex, it allows us to point at one target and say, that is the problem, or they are the problem. And if we can get rid of it or them, then everything will be better. It's so naive, yet it is so inherently human.
What I'm worried about is that humans will make similar mistakes in the information environment like they did in the physical environment. So in the past, we've done rather stupid things to solve a specific problem with little consideration for what the cascading effects of that change would be. For example, introducing cane toads in Australia to deal with a pest on sugarcane crops. Apparently it worked really well in South America or somewhere in the South to deal with pests. It was a natural animal where it started, but putting it in Australia was a disaster. There are now like a billion cane toads in Australia. They're a scourge. Children are paid money to kill them and round them up. They are a toxin, so anything that eats them, including many endangered species in Australia, die if they eat them. It's a serious problem that now cannot be dealt with. It's an invasive species. And so we've done the same thing with like pesticides. Why are bees dying? Because we're using a pesticide that kills them, but we need them because, you know, they pollinate flowers, etc. And so what I'm worried about is that in our reaction to disinformation, which I agree is a problem, there is something inherently disturbing about, you know, lies or, you know, things that impede our ability to make rational decisions in our own best interest, even. There is something disconcerting about it, but trying to root it out by banning it or blocking it isn't probably going to lead to the answer that we want. And the reason why I'm saying this is because I think there's questions about scale and scope of like how much something spreads. And maybe that is a place which there are experiments to do, like experiments in doing that. But the overall concern is that the way that we're studying this now isn't going to lead to answers about the efficacy of those interventions, much less the cascading effects. It's super expensive to just try to study one type of intervention to something like disinformation. And if you're going to do that in relation to the major tech platforms, it becomes even harder because most researchers don't have access inside. They don't know whether tweaks on that platform may be affecting their study. And if there's research being done inside the platforms, we don't really know about it because it's not coming out and seeing the light of day. So our understanding is really, really low in terms of the interventions we're making. We are at that space of introducing cane toads to Australia, except the challenge here is like, yes, we're not destroying a physical environment, but we might be because we're going to depend on these people to be able to be informed later in that information environment to stop something like climate change. And I think that this is a really pressing concern as a result.
A common tactic, obviously, like, that occurred was like just deplatforming people. And you talk about this in your piece, that we just like deplatformed individuals who we were convinced were spreading disinformation. And I've spoken to some other people who had sort of along a similar vein were like, we shouldn't have deplatformed people. We should have just engaged them in debate on the platforms.
As a researcher who really would like evidence-informed policy, I couldn't tell you because I don't know. I don't have the evidence to support one way or another whether it should have happened or shouldn't have happened. My sense is that deplatforming doesn't take those views or those people away. And on social media is only like one form of communication available to them. And depending on how high profile those people were and their other means of being able to communicate with people, particularly whether they're going to get taken up in traditional media. This is the other thing. The interplay between social media and traditional media is often ignored or not seen or missed. And they're deeply, deeply interconnected. So banning somebody like Trump certainly didn't take him out of circulation. And it certainly didn't stop the people who already had come to believe and trust him from believing anything further that he would say. So my sense is that while it's a punishment and while it may make us feel good about removing a problem, that problem isn't really taken away or dealt with.
It's made cooler. There's nothing cooler than reading a banned book, right? I remember.
But that's the scarcity heuristic, right? And it also allowed people to kind of be martyrs of a sort. There's a good book by Ruth Wodak, I want to say. And it looks at how
especially populists on the right have managed to create a cycle whereby they create a scandal, get the media coverage, dominate media coverage. And then by the time the opposition realizes what's happened, they're on to the next scandal. And through this whole kind of like scandal cycle, they're able to basically capture public attention over a longer term and dominate it. And I think that there's a lot to be said for that and the interplay between what happens in social media, even if it's a deplatforming, and the media coverage that results in it.
So are we handling information the wrong way? I mean, disinformation, whatever it is, has been around forever, and there isn't really a lot we can do to make it stop. So what can we do? Is democracy in trouble? Prior to doing what I do now for money, I used to be a teacher. So I taught in school for like 12 years. And I had always kind of, and maybe it influences my thought process on this for sure. But, I find like education can be a bit of like, I don't use the term panacea because I don't think that exists, but education itself creates the ability to be critical and to be skeptical. I feel like tackling the education problem, I think, is that part of the solution here? We need to be better at teaching kids to be critical. We need to be better at, as you say, dealing with social issues such as poverty, racism, all of these things. Addressing these concepts will help ease, let's say, disinformation in the information pool.
I think that education is really important, and we're missing some fundamental basics to prepare kids for coping in general. So, for example, I don't know about you, but I don't really remember being taught about our inability to assess risk, that we are just fundamentally flawed as humans. And I'm feeling like coming out of the pandemic, a better understanding of our weaknesses around risk might have been helpful for the general public. I'm not entirely convinced that we teach a whole lot of critical thinking in schools. I think that we have curriculum in which we want them to learn certain subjects and they repeat it back to us through tests and stuff like that. But it's not necessarily teaching people to be much more than functional citizens in a capitalist democratic society. So there's that, but then there's this whole like elephant in the room, which is like all of the other people who have already been through school and are never going back to school. So how are you going to reach them and make sure that they are prepared to live in a modern information environment and that they understand how information is manipulated and put in front of them? Like, we're missing all of that kind of education, campaign or continued education campaign to keep people literate, understanding, you know, sources and where they're getting things from. But then you mentioned politicians, and this seems to me to be one of the biggest problems that we're facing in democracies, and that is the behavior of many of our politicians who will say and do just about anything in order to get power. I find it deeply disturbing that in Canada, we have a party that has continued to call for defunding of the public broadcaster. This is an institution that has rules governing how it can work such that it can maintain its independence. It is one of the only sources of information in Canada that is not co-opted by political interests. And we have politicians who have been for like decades calling to defund it. And I find all of that deeply disturbing. And so I'm not sure who and how reckons that. How do we reckon with that in democratic societies? But I can't help but shake that the most predominant source of disinformation, the most high profile sources of it, are politicians.
Shots fired.
I mean, I think that many studies are showing great signs of concern that validate what I'm saying. So there's a think tank out of Sweden called Ideas that does an annual state of democracy study. And for the last few years, more countries have been becoming authoritarian than have been becoming more democratic. We have a backslide around the world of democracies into authoritarianism, and in large part because of the ways they're trying to control the information environment. And the sad part is, the sad reality of this is that we really only seem to have this one model of governance at this point in time, because leading democracies haven't really articulated principles guiding what should be interventions. We're like reacting to singular things. So if you want an example of this, I would point to India. India has really been backsliding in large part because of some of the controls that they're implementing over the internet, pushing on journalists, really trying to dominate like with one worldview in a very diverse country, which is increasingly problematic. I think we run that risk. And there was a couple of years ago, Pakistan led with a few other not so democratic countries, including Russia, a resolution on disinformation at the UN. And so here you have these authoritarian states that are presenting a view of best practices. They want to collect best practices on how to counter disinformation. And so they're really using that whole concept too as a means for greater control over their individual information ecosystems and what that means. And that's what I worry about, right? Because if we're looking at content moderation, banning things, banning users, banning certain types of speech, how are we any different?
I see the point, right? From the Russian perspective, the information that comes out of our side of the world, right, is considered disinformation to sort of Kremlin state authority. And then anything that they create is propaganda. Therefore, it's it's disinformation to our state authority. Like I see the point. It's interesting. It's very Orwellian. Like I'm reminded of truth is this very kind of malleable and flexible thing.
This has ever been the case, right? Like humans will have problems and challenges understanding their world around them, and they're going to make things up and they're going to believe certain things. But I think the bigger question would be, why are we so afraid of something like disinformation? Are we looking at the underlying factors as to why people might be more susceptible? I think we focus so much on the content and what to do about the content. We're overlooking things like, gee, racism, like economic inequality, the fact that there have been like maybe massive shifts in society recently. And those things cause people to be upset. And when they're upset and they're losing trust in institutions and media, which if we take the Edelman study that it goes out every year, citizens across many democracies are losing faith in governments, media, other institutions in terms of if companies. And so what do we expect? Like, it might be that it isn't the disinformation itself. It's that people have just lost faith in modern times.
As someone who is a student of disinformation, Dr. Wanless raises a lot of solid points. To circle back to the top with King Charles I, disinformation played a role in him losing his head. But he was also killed by his own ego and by his hubris and his inability to listen to others, to take their wants, needs, and ideas into consideration. He lost his head because of his desire for power, and that he was motivated by some delusion of grandeur, honestly believing that he was appointed by God to rule, and therefore, his truth was the only truth. A lot has changed since Charles I held the throne, yet so much has stayed the same. Thank you to Dr. Alicia Wanless for coming on today's episode. Links to her work are in the show notes. If you like the show, leaving us a rating and review would be great. Also, you could share it around on your socials, post about it on your favorite dark web forums, send a link of this show to your favorite politician. It all helps. For more OSINT content, news, updates, and articles, please visit www.sapperlabs.com. Thanks for listening. I'm MJ Benias. This is Cloak and Dagger, and good hunting.